Welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. Hang on. That's strange because I didn't even have it on loop and then it looped the track again.
I thought you were echoing for a second there.
Yeah, no, crazy. Yeah. But welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. I'm your host, Will Wheeler, joined with my main man, Photon John. What's going on, brother, besides those technical difficulties?
Just recovering from a relaxing weekend on the beach, you know, a hard life. How about yourself?
Yeah, man. What did I do on the weekend? I think I just had a chilled out weekend. I think it was just one of those weekends where I'd had a pretty crazy week the week before, but this one was sort of like a longer type of weekend. So I think I had some business meetings. I think I could. I'm trying to get on some podcasts as well, just boost my brand and all that type of stuff. So I've sort of been reaching out to a few people there. So I think I had some meetings with some people there, but I think we went to the movies, went and saw the Barbie movie. So, you know, keeping the
wife happy. You're going to see Oppenheimer?
We did see that. We saw that days later. Yep.
Was it great?
Yep. Yeah, it was good. It was good. Honestly, I'd say that, like, if you're going to watch it, make sure you go to the toilet before and don't drink too much in there. It's like a three-hour film. It's a three-hour film. It's crazy. Yeah. But anyway, we should get stuck into this today, and I need to just get up what we're going to be talking to about. So today we've got a guest all the way from the UK to talk to us about how neurodiversity is understood in the social worker. Hang on, I had it come up. Profession, we've got Deb Solomon all the way from the UK. Deb, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. It's early morning here, but yes, all good.
Early morning, I tell you what. And this is the thing, like, I don't usually have a wine, but today I had some wine left over. So for all of our listeners who are listening from overseas, no, I'm not a raging alcoholic. It is 5:30 here. All right, so it's okay to have a wine. So nothing like a good wine on a Monday afternoon. But, Deb, thank you so much for joining us. How was your weekend?
It was okay. It was raining all weekend. I also went to see the Barbie movie.
Oh, what was your thoughts?
Do you know what? I thought it was, as a mother, I thought it was quite emotional. I think I did like, there was quite a lot in there that was like, there was a lot of pink going on, though.
Was there, would you say it brought back some memories?
For sure. I've got two teenage kids, so it hit home.
Wow, crazy. Look, I think for me there were some funny parts in it. Which was sort of cool, especially when they, like, went into the real world type of thing.
Hey, spoilers.
What's that?
Spoilers.
Yeah, but that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to give away the storyline or what happens in the end.
Yeah.
But, it was okay, I suppose. But I don't know. I've probably seen some other movies that I thought probably top my list. But, hey, look, that's just me. Maybe that was the best movie in the world for some people. Kev, I highly recommend you go watch it. I think you'd really love it, mate.
Okay.
You would fit right in.
But I actually really want to watch it.
Okay, yeah, look, check it out. It's actually quite funny, you know what I mean?
It's quite funny.
You know? But before we get stuck into this, let's just do our normal housekeeping. So for anyone listening, please subscribe, like, and follow to all of our social media platforms. We're available on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. I want to say Twitter, but really it's X now, isn't it? Okay, so check us out on X. Thank you, Mr. Elon Musk, for changing that for us. Now I'm going to have to update the logo on all of my social media. We're also available on Twitch, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And please subscribe to our website at the openheartedsociety.com website. Photon John, you ready to rock and roll, my man?
I just have a cup in my face, but yes, I'm good.
Good job. Deb, you know, like you said, you've shared a little bit about yourself, but maybe to share a little bit more in depth about, you know, who you are, maybe some of the challenges you've faced and so forth about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of people, I was diagnosed in 2020 in lockdown. So I'm a social worker, started working from home, and just that kind of being out of the routine, sitting at home, working, I don't know if it was the overwhelm that hit, but I just found it really hard to function, just get stuff done. And I was sitting, and I'm guessing probably a lot of people that listen to this will resonate with that. You know, when you're sitting and you're looking and you're thinking, oh, I've got loads of stuff to do, but my brain says no. So I'm just staring and I'm not doing anything. And it's now been 5 hours and I'm going to get sacked soon, was how it all happened.
So I'm assuming you're diagnosed with ADHD?
I was diagnosed with ADHD and I'm on the waiting list for autism.
It
was really, really difficult working from home. And I think that's what pushed me to go for the diagnosis. But I never for a second dreamt it would be ADHD because, and I'll talk about this in a bit, but it's just not something that we are taught about or that I really knew about because I'm not male and I'm not a child, which is how I saw ADHD. So.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I was only diagnosed with ADHD last year as well. And, you know, for a long time, I'm dyslexic and I've always known I was dyslexic. But I think the biggest thing with ADHD as well is, especially when you're young, you know, growing up, you think it's this crazy kid in class who can't sit still or all of that type of stuff. And I was probably a crazy kid in class, but I wasn't, I wouldn't say that I was heaps hyperactive or anything. So when a friend reached out to me and said, hey, Will, I think you're ADHD, I think that was the bit of the surprise, like, oh my God. But I think this is the thing, we're seeing more awareness around it and everything now that it's like, oh, well, yeah, I do that. And yeah, I do that. And do you know what I mean? Even like you just explaining that stuff, I didn't even know, but I'm just like, sounds like you're ADHD, yeah?
yeah. And it's just, so for me, yeah, I was definitely not a hyperactive child. I was the kid in the back corner kind of staring into space and making up stories and like drawing on my hands and all of that stuff, kind of trying to be mostly invisible wherever I could, which now I can see, like, there's lots of signs. But yeah, it was a real surprise to me.
And I think this, oh, sorry, you go, Kev.
I was going to say, you know, I found out after we were or had already been doing this podcast for a while, because I had that misconception about ADHD. I didn't realize it because I suffer a lot from the paralysis side of things with tasks. Yeah. And yeah, so that was a bit of an eye opener that I could even be someone who's had ADHD, sorry, who's been aware of autism all their life, you know, works on a podcast in the neurodiversity field and still didn't quite have the right perception of what ADHD was.
Yeah, it's crazy. Sorry, I've just had a guy called Scott Richardson. Is this a connection of yours, Deb? Yeah. I agree 100% with what Deb says. Working environment is very difficult to get right when working from home or office. So many factors influence you, light, sound, movement. It's very difficult for employees to understand this. Mm. Yeah, I definitely would agree with that because I think for myself, I found that like the biggest problem I would find is when I'm working from home and I'm in dead silence. It's almost like a creepy type of feeling. So I've got to have, even like if I'm not working, I still need to have like the TV playing in the background. Same. I need, you know what I mean? I need, and you know, people would come in and be like, why you got the bloody TV on? You know what I mean? You're wasting electricity. And it's like, I seriously need that to almost calm me. I might not even be listening to what's going on the TV, but I need that, right? But in saying that, everyone's different. We've all got our own different ways. So for yourself, Deb, like once you got that diagnosis, how did that help you to, because obviously you're working from home a lot now, like we were talking before. What type of things changed for you?
I think, so, for example, that when I said I was sitting and feeling really overwhelmed, I would force myself to sit there. I could be sitting there for, you know, 6-7 hours trying to make myself work and forcing myself, and I'd be in tears because it's like, why is my brain not doing this? Mm. Whereas I think once I got diagnosed, it was that freedom to say, do you know what, I need to step away for a minute. Mm. I need to do something to kind of restart it and then come back, and that's okay. I'm not going to get into trouble for doing that, you know. It's because we're all on Microsoft Teams, and you've got the little green or red circle, don't you, telling you whether you're active or not. Mm. And I think that puts so much pressure, like you must not leave your space. But it's just, I think it just kind of said, you know, it is not you, because I always had that, you know, that should word, like you should be able to be like everyone else, you should be able to work like everyone else, you should be able to focus. I think I just stopped using that so much and kind of like, well, I do, just in a different way. It took me a while to get used to that. But even like now, I'm sat, I've got my new spinny chair so I can spin. I've got my little fiddly thing that I sit and fiddle while I'm chatting and stuff. I wouldn't have done that before because I didn't think you were supposed to.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, like, even just like, even like myself, I'll sit here with a pen sometimes and just being able to have that thing to play with, it does. I don't know why it does that. I'm not sure. I'm sure there's people who are listening to this podcast who know exactly what happens, but it's just stimulating our brain, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
But this is the thing. Even for me, like, I like to have, like, a game. Like, I've got, like, sports apps on my phone where I like to have that playing. And I can sort, even if it's a replay of something, I'll have that playing because it feels like something's going on. And I can just, for some reason I can focus, where other people, they just couldn't do that type of thing. So it's really interesting how it works. Hang on, we've got someone who's just come through, Mandy Webb. That's so important to know when to step away and give yourself permission. Yeah, totally, you know. And do you know what else I've sort of found as well? For me, I work well at different times. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the whole 9-to-5 thing doesn't necessarily work for me. Sometimes I need to start that little bit later, or there's other times where I can just get straight into it. And I will just nail that, and I will be on top of everything like that. And it's like, oh, my God, I've got way too much time on my hands. Or I need to go have a break for, like, 2 hours instead of, like, a half-hour lunchtime and then get back into it. Or I'll even do work late at night and I feel like I'm on top of the stuff for the next day. I don't know. It's just working your normal 9-to-5 just sometimes doesn't work for us.
That sounds so familiar. I do a lot of my admin stuff because we have a lot of reports to write, as you can imagine. I do a lot of that at night just because my brain, we finish at 5, about 4:30, my brain kind of does the, oh, we can work now. So that's when it kicks in. So I've started acknowledging that on those days where I'm not massively productive, I know I'm probably going to have a couple of days where I do more than I would in like 3 days straight. It works out over the week.
Yeah. Is it, I know for me, because I'm exactly the same as both of you with that. For me, it's that the working day is finished. And I know I'm not going to be hassled to pressured to work a certain way. It's like, well, it's nighttime now. No one's going to call me. I can do this the way that it works for me. You know, and I can, walk away every, half hour to an hour for 5 minutes just to reset the brain and then come back to it. And then, because I'm just way more productive like that. And I get so much more done.
Yeah,
and it feels freeing, to work out.
And I struggle with transitions between stuff. So, when I'm working on one thing and then someone rings about something else. Mm. And I think it's that knowledge that that's not going to happen, that I can just do my thing.
Do you know what, right? With myself, there's times where I have to do like 45 minute presentations, right? To conferences and stuff like that. So I've got to create you know, a PowerPoint, right? And for me, I just can't sit down for like the day and create a PowerPoint. I can only do a certain period. What I normally do is sort of get a skeleton, lay it out, and that's enough for me. Then I'll add a little bit more. So sometimes I need to work on those things months prior and do that little bit every now and then. So by the time the due date comes, it's all ready to rock and roll type of thing. I feel like, but you know what? I've had things where I've had big reports to do and I've done it like that. And then something's happened where my computer's crashed and I've lost everything and it's all due the next day. You know what I mean? So you're going into this frustration mode, but that's a whole nother story. But I tell you what, we should get stuck into this, you know. We're here to talk. We're probably going on a bit of an ADHD bender right now. All good. So look, you know, we're here to hear about, you know, neurodiversity, especially in the social worker, you know, area. You know, so tell us a little bit about your work, just so people have a bit of a better understanding of what it is, what it actually is, and what actually you do.
So, yeah, so my role's changed a few times. So I've always worked with adults, vulnerable adults. So that's kind of 18 plus, and that will be everything to do with domestic violence, hoarding, self-neglect, all that kind of stuff. I've now moved into a team where I'm working with students and newly qualified social workers. And so a lot of the work that I do within my actual role, my actual sort of local authority role, is supporting newly qualified, especially neurodivergent newly qualified social workers. It's interesting because we don't talk about it that much in our profession, which you would think we would be in.
Well, I'm assuming that it would be very high rate of neurodivergent people.
Yeah, and it's not. So what? When I was diagnosed, I kind of straight away reached out to see if there was some peer support type thing to do with social work, because I think in social work, there's a lot of pressures that maybe you don't necessarily have if you're not in this profession. So I wanted to kind of talk to people that understood all of that, and it just didn't exist. So I set up my group, which I think that's most of the work that we're doing. So we've got a group across the UK now for neurodivergent social workers. And I thought, I don't know, we'll get like 20 people. We've got like 200 odd members so far. And what we're kind of doing is we're working with all of our organisations. So we've got British Association of Social Workers, we've got Social Work England, and we've got Social Work Union, and we're producing things like practice guidance, how to work with us as professionals, how to work with us, how we need to, I guess, work at our best. We've got a campaign running at the moment called Celebrating Neurodivergent Social Workers, just to try and change the culture, I guess, and try and normalize and just try and say, you know what, we're here. Because when I first set up the group, all of the messages that I was receiving was people kind of going, whoa, there's other people. I didn't realize there was other people like me in this.
Yeah, totally.
And that really came through, was just that feeling that there's so many people that have felt isolated.
I say, just on that, right, that it is so important once we start talking about certain subjects, especially within certain areas, how many other people are probably thinking the exact same, you're not that only one type of thing. So I think this is where it is important that we start sharing these types of things, because you'd be surprised how many people come out of the woodwork there.
Yeah, definitely. And we do, so I do a lot of training across the UK around, especially for, so we have what's called practice educators. They're the people who, when a student social worker goes on placement, as part of their training, they have a practice educator that supports them through. So we do a lot of the training for them to kind of say, you know, look, these are the things that you might see. This is how to get the best out of your student. I really try and put a focus on positives. And I do a lot of training as well around safeguarding. So other of the people that come into us, how we can work differently to, you know, get the best outcomes, really, and understand those different ways of communicating, because we're not taught it at uni. ever.
Yeah.
Not mentioned.
Yeah, totally, totally. But just before we move on, I do want to ask, so if there are people listening, if you do have any questions for Deb or ourselves or just in general, please feel free to fire them through. And if they're relevant to what we're talking about, we'll definitely love to talk. Reason why I say that is I've had people ask stupid questions about something that has nothing to do with the topic. So I've sort of got to put that out there. But, you know, it's interesting to hear that, you know, you're getting a lot of response from that. People are starting to go, hey, look, this is me. But talking about that, what interactions do you have with neurodivergent people in social work? So you said you were doing stuff with schools or that. Are you working with the prisons and stuff like that, or, you know, things like that? Is there a different way to approach certain things? Because like you said, it's not taught in unis or anything like that. So I'm assuming you're probably making a lot of this up type of thing as you go type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of the, so I do a lot of safeguarding training. Most of mine is based around adults because that's my background. So I do a lot of stuff. We get a lot of people, you know, especially things like hoarding cases. We get a lot of hoarding cases, and there's been loads of studies that have shown that link between ADHD and hoarding, for example. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of stuff with sort of training around just the impact of, you know, when I think back to me as a social worker before I knew all of this, the amount of times that I would just think, I'll just pop in to see so-and-so because I'm in the area without having told them that I was going to go, or without thinking about the time of day, or without giving them any context on my visit. All of that is such a massive impact, isn't it, on how they're going to work with me. And I've done quite a bit of work around, we have this horrible term in the UK called non-engagement. You often see it on notes, you know, so-and-so didn't engage. And that frustrates me because I don't think anyone doesn't engage. I think we haven't worked in a way that they can accept our support.
They can feel comfortable type of thing.
Yeah. Right? So I'm assuming, if you turn up like that, of course they're going to be like, go away.
Well, I'm assuming that, I hate, you know, even when I've worked at places and then say your boss turns up out of the blue without like giving you a heads up, it feels like that you're not trusted or they're looking, you know what I mean? So you're losing that, what's the word I'm looking for? You're losing that respect.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's sort of like you need to respect them to get the same respect back, if that makes sense.
I think it can be a hard thing because when you're in a state of meltdown or burnout, you know, and I think it's something to be said for how, you know, early intervention can really help children be be better than nonverbal. And I think a lot of it is just the overwhelming states that you can find yourself in sometimes with autism or ADHD, and the just complete lack of respect for that state. I think is largely due to just complete lack of education. No one understands, you know, they're going off a neurotypical rule book. But yeah, it sort of ties back into that permission side of things. You know, it's something I've had to realize is that unfortunately, no matter how anyone perceives it, even if they think I'm being rude, I have to give myself the permission to go, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you right now. Or, but getting the respect for that, I can imagine in social work it'd be even more intense for clients. Is a difficult ask to get the broader community to really start understanding it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for us as a profession as well, so I guess most of my work probably is actually us as a profession. So the social workers who are neurodivergent. And I think there's such a lack of understanding. I mean, I personally, I've had, even in my local authority, I've had comments like, oh, I didn't know autistic people could be social workers. How do you manage that then? You know, and questions like, you know, but what about the empathy? How do you manage to have empathy? All that, you know, there's such a lack of understanding. But I think in terms of clients, we have, especially young people that are leaving care, there's a really high percentage of those are neurodivergent. And I think there's such a lot of pressure on them to kind of suddenly go into this adult world, probably half of them aren't diagnosed, to be able to function, and they're labeled, and it's difficult.
Sorry, you go, Kev.
You sure? Okay.
Yeah, you're right.
Can I ask, you know, how do you manage, you know, as a social worker, how do you teach them to manage? Because it is a very people intensive job.
Yeah.
And that is one thing, I guess, that is a bit of a stereotype, but also quite true, is it is a very people intensive job, and it can be tiring for, you know, neurotypical people even, who are well, you know, well able to cope with that sort of stuff. How do you manage that as a social worker?
Yeah, I mean, I get peopled out for sure. but I think what it is because we manage our own diaries generally,
right.
I will plan that out. So if I've got a really people intensive day, my next day is going to be admin, because need to be away. And I really try to make sure. So if I'm doing something where, for example, we've got, if we have team meetings that are like 3 hours long and there's loads of people, I will make sure that I've booked out a couple of hours in my day to kind of recharge from that. Yeah. What I've struggled with being at home is the lack of driving around. So, you know, normally when you do something, like go to something, you drive to the next place and there's time to kind of
a break.
And that we don't get that when you're at home. So I've started doing things like putting that in. So even if it's just 10 minutes, I've got like audiobooks on my phone, and I will literally put 10 minutes of just that, just to kind of like, right, okay, next one, to give that space, which helps.
Yeah, totally, totally. Sorry, we've just had Scott come through again, and he's asked, how can we educate employers with support through, sorry, I just want to make sure I read that correctly. How can we educate employers with support through reasonable adjustments to support social workers to work at their best?
Yeah, it's. I think the problem we have, especially here with reasonable adjustments, is there's this assumption that you're going to feel safe to say to your employer, hey, I'm whatever. Then they're going to say, well, what do you need? And you don't know.
Yeah.
Precisely what happened to me. That, you know, I said, I have ADHD. They said, what do you need? And I was like, I don't know, because I've always been me. So I don't know.
Do you know what? It's the same in education as well. You know, you're going, hey, look, I'm this, I need reasonable adjustments, or I need support. And a lot of the time they have no idea. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, and I've even been in the same boat as that. I've said, hey, I'm dyslexic. And then the employers have had no idea. And then in certain situations, they've put me in situations where I've had to work to my weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I had to do meetings minutes one time. And I look like a complete fool, because as a dyslexic person trying to get what someone's saying into my brain then onto paper is just like throwing me under the bus big time.
Yeah. What I've started saying to people, so in answer to that question, is in a way it's kind of moving away from the diagnosis, because as soon as you say as well, like, hey, I have ADHD, like there's that thing, isn't there, of, oh, okay, so you're not going to be able to focus, you're not going to be able to do this. And then so I've kind of started to say to people, do you know what, rather than saying that, almost think about things like executive functioning. So say to the person, like, right, in my day, this is the moment where I get frustrated, or I'm challenged, or I'm not able to perform at the best ability. So at that moment, this is a thing. And when you kind of just break it down to that, it's much, much easier to work with your manager to say, right, okay, so for me, example, like being time blind, I know I don't always manage my time the best, so we can then cut that, you know, break that down, right, what would help with that thing. It's just, and I suppose it's how we do assessments for social work, and it whenever I do an assessment, my very first question to someone is, tell me how your day runs, start from the beginning, in the morning when you wake up, talk me through your day. And it's the same for us, when is those moments where we get stuck, and what's happening at that point, rather than, hey, I've got this, adjust please. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. You know, but, and I think it also does come down to the attitude of, say, the employer in this case as well, because I've had times where I've said, hey, look, I'm dyslexic, I really struggle with the way you're doing this, And then they pretty much just looked at me and gone, I couldn't care, and given me the stuff. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
if I hadn't have been needing the job at the time, I probably would have turned around and told them to shove it up their ass. Yeah. But do you know what I mean? Because it just felt like a ripe insult, you know. So that was where it sort of, you know. But I've actually got someone else who's just come through with something as well. Am I pronouncing it correct? Margaret Knowles? Did I pronounce that correct? Yeah, cool. From a teacher's perspective, I ask my students what helps them first rather than offering a generic support. Often they are unsure, but the conversation is so valuable. Cool. And that's the thing, you know, maybe even the students still learning themselves, but at least we're having these conversations. And I think from a tertiary education perspective, because that's sort of my background, you know, having these conversations prior to someone actually starting, you know, study or something like that, at least you're able to maybe go away and think about it and go, well, maybe this would help me, or I do struggle with this. So, you know, you've got a bit of a plan together by the time you're ready to start whatever that is or whatever. So, yeah, cool. Hey, Photon John, did you have anything else you wanted to say on that, mate?
No, I think Deb's covered it pretty clearly.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, we've spoken about a lot of different things. So what are some of the issues you find around social worker, around social – did we spell that wrong? So no, I think it should be social work and neurodiversity, right? So you've sort of said I think you've sort of explained a few of the issues, a bit of a misunderstanding, lack of understanding, stuff like that. So I think we should move on to the next one. What do you reckon, Kev?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. I just wanted to mention very quickly with that one. So we did a study, right, when I first started setting up this group around psychological safety and how psychologically safe social workers feel to seek support. And over 60% said they didn't feel safe. So that was just something that I wanted to mention, because for me that's the biggest issue. If you don't feel safe to ask because of either the stigma or that lack of understanding, that's where the issues are happening. So it's all around creating that safe space.
And I think that's probably a lot broader than just social work as well, because, you know, studying the same and any type of workplace, and I think probably having that real lack of understanding still is probably the real culprit there, because, you know, do you say something can then be, oh, so Photon John made that mistake because he's this. Don't get him to do that again or whatever like that. I think that's a real poor way to look at it, type of thing. So we've actually
also in social work, what tends to happen is because we have crazy caseloads, it's really, really busy. Mm. There's that danger of saying, ah, you're struggling because you are autistic, for example, rather than saying, actually, maybe you're struggling because the job's really hard and you've got a really busy caseload. Mm. So, you know, you don't always have to blame.
People do, yeah, people do. And any mistake you make really in a workplace can be, it's, you're at risk of being pigeonholed as that's the reason you're making a mistake.
Do you know what, right, but like now when I think, you know, especially for myself going into a lot of leadership roles, I have my own company, all of that, I actually, you know, being neurodivergent and I suppose practicing what I preach, I do look at a lot of stuff differently. So say, for example, I was to see, I don't know, Deb, you were struggling with something and all of that, rather than going, oh, she's ADHD, so yeah, no wonder she did this wrong. I normally look at it now like, oh, wow, maybe what should we do to be able to help her to be able to get on top of that type of thing? Do you know what I mean? Because I think that's a big that's the team. You're a team member. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think it's really a team if we're relying on each one to do their job. How are we able to help each other, type of thing? That's just me as a neurodivergent leader, I suppose, just looking at this whole perspective differently. But, you know, not everyone's like that. Do you know what I mean? And yeah. Some people are just quick to throw people under the bus a lot of the time. Sorry, Kev, you did say that we did cover sort of this one before.
Yeah.
So what are some of the issues you find around clients and neurodiversity? But, you know, we've spoken a little bit about ADHD, dyslexia and stuff like that, but I'm assuming that also too, we've probably got some people who are very suicidal, have had, I don't know, PTSD, stuff like that, which is probably even more intense when you're neurodivergent as well. Have you had experiences like that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you think about how we work, what we kind of do as social workers is we'll go out to see somebody, won't we, and we'll do the whole kind of, right, if this happens, this is who you contact, or if this happens, this is the plan to put in place, which you can take when you're not in crisis. But when you're in crisis, you can't remember that stuff. That stuff doesn't kick in. And I think that's something that I've really noticed and started to change in my work is when I'm having that conversation, am I relying on someone to be able to answer the phone or make a phone call? Am I relying on somebody to be able to articulate, okay, this is what I'm in now? And am I relying on them to remember all that stuff that I've just said of who to contact when that happens? Because that's how we work. I never used to send stuff out in writing, for example. So if I said, when this happens, do this. Now I will send all of that out in bullet points in writing so they've got it somewhere and they can see. Because when you're in crisis like that, you don't think, oh, I remember last week.
Yeah. Just being able to read an email is difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, especially if you're going through severe depression and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. But
when it happens to me, I call it notification anxiety.
Yeah.
Just my phone going off with a notification can make me stress out sometimes. You know?
Yeah.
Also, definitely. Man, thanks to Scott for throwing through all these questions today. Go, Scott. All right, so we've got my main man, Scott, again. Evidence – so I'm just trying to read how – maybe I'm reading this wrong. How can evidence neurodivergence needs against the eligibility criteria? I think we've missed a few words there, but that's okay. Do we sort of get what we mean there?
Yeah. So we have to, when we're assessing, especially in adult care, there's an eligibility criteria. We have to go through a load of domains to say, does this person meet the criteria to ask to get support? And normally, so it might be things like, can they wash and dress themselves? Can they use the toilet themselves? That kind of thing. But for me, when I ask these questions now, it's firstly, it's about what happens on those bad days. So it's not, obviously, you know, the person generally will be able to physically dress themselves, but actually when executive dysfunction's kicking in, can you do that? And what does that look like? So it's asking those questions around, on a bad day, what is getting dressed for you like? You can physically do it, but your brain won't let you, or you can't see the process, you know, and you do that sort of stuck, and I don't know what to get first or what to do first. So it's asking those questions that helps.
Yeah, crazy. Just out of curiosity, you know, and I was only having a conversation about this stuff the other day, and, you know, we're talking about it before, diagnosis, right? Diagnosis can be so difficult for people, especially in the work you're doing, because it costs so much. Do you know what I mean? And these people need it probably, I wouldn't say any more than you or me, but they need it. Do you know what I mean? Because a lot of the time they can't get the proper medication or support to be able to function correctly or to get better.
Yeah.
Is there type of things? I don't know if it's – I don't know what it's like in Australia. I know what it's like in Australia, sorry. It's very poor. But what about in the UK? Is there, like, support to get these people – diagnosed, or is it like they've still got to try and fork out $3,000 or whatever to go get a diagnosis?
You can do it through the NHS, but there's about 2 to 3 year waiting lists. And what I tend to find as well happens is, so there's a lot of different services. So we'll have someone that comes in, for example, who, as you mentioned earlier, might be in crisis, might have mental health issues, might also be neurodivergent, might also have some sort of addiction. And what tends to happen is they get batted between the services. So mental health services will go, oh, we don't know how to do that because they're autistic. And then that tends to come under then the LD services, because for some reason we haven't quite figured out how to separate neurodiversity and learning disabilities yet. But they'll kind of go, oh, we can't help you because you've got mental health stuff going on. And then the substance misuse or addiction services will go, oh, yeah, no, but we can't work with you because you're either autistic or you have mental health. And then
it's just like a tennis game, right?
Yeah.
All just hitting them backwards. And you're probably finding, and this is what I've noticed with a lot of people that I've spoken to in the past, it's a circle. You sometimes end up back from where, pardon me, from where you started from, which is crazy.
Yeah, definitely. And it is frustrating. And I've had so many conversations with other professionals that have kind of said, you know, you don't get one without the other. You can still work with somebody. You just need to think about your communication. And actually, most of the stuff we need isn't hard, is it, really? Mm. It's just different ways of communicating. It's just, you know, just you call them, don't make them call you. Like, that's not hard.
Yeah, totally. You know, and from going on from that, which probably works in perfectly, what changes would you like to see in the area to better support neurodiversity?
I think just better training. So, for example, when we're at university, we do a 3-year degree. It's not mentioned once, unless we're focusing on people that have really, really high support needs. So the only thing we ever mentioned, for example, about autism was those people that potentially live in supported living that, you know, need 24/7 support. We didn't talk about people like us at all that may well need support but don't necessarily look like they do. So it's training. It's, I think, just normalizing, talking about it. We need to happen. And I think certainly within teams, we need to be discussing things like, what do you need to work at your best? And that should be for anyone. What do you need to work at your best? What do you need to achieve your best? Rather than waiting for someone to have a diagnosis to have that conversation, we should just have that anyway, because everyone needs to, I don't know, sit somewhere quiet when they're trying to concentrate, for example, don't they?
And can I also say, even having someone that is there for you or sort of understands what you're going through is key as well.
Yeah.
Peer support. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how many times where I've talked about certain issues with stuff that I've struggled with and still do struggle with in regards to addiction and other things, and just being able to sit down with that person and speak about something that they're potentially going through. It's like what you said before with people started to come out of the woodwork when you started to speak about that. Yeah. It's almost like a breath of fresh air. You're like, oh my God, it's just good. I feel like this. And do you, you know, I feel this and, you know, I want to do that. And it's not like you're the, because say if I say it to someone who doesn't get it, you've almost got that like feel sorry for me factor. Yeah. And I don't want people to feel sorry for me at all. I just want people to understand what I'm going through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. That's come through. So, I mean, sometimes the meetings that we have are so emotional. There's people coming along that are literally in tears going, I just didn't know. Mm. I didn't know there was other people around. But I think the last thing we should do, and really to better support, is actually talk to people. You know, talk. So many people that I've worked with client-wise who I've kind of had a bit of a conversation about, for example, executive functioning. And I've said, do you know that when this is happening, you know, that's not your fault? And they've just been like, no one's ever said that to me, because we're scared of just talking.
I know I have at various points through my diagnosis process and talking with professionals and just other you know, neurodivergent people, and even just watching videos online, just burst out crying.
Yeah.
Because to finally hear someone say something that, you know, understands me so well, because you do feel quite alone and isolated a lot of the time.
Well, you know, I know, you know, and it's funny. All right. Also, too, by the way, Kev, I've got a really cool guest. Not as cool as the guest we've got on right now, but we've got another cool guest coming on in like a few months, right? Mm. And I remember we had a thing here called like, it was like a mental health meetup thing. And we'd meet up and we'd sort of go into a circle and people would share like certain mental health things that they were going through. And we all had different issues. But I actually left a lot of those events after sharing what I was going through. You know, I was struggling with depression. It was just after the pandemic. That was very hard to sort of get through. And I sort of left those events feeling somewhat better, not 100%, but a little bit better, because I felt like I was around others who were similar to myself and I could hear that others were sort of going through other things, if that makes sense. And it does play such a huge role.
Well, you spend a lot of time being, you know, spoken to as though you're wrong, like as in you as a person, a wrong person for operating the way that you do, from people who just either aren't educated, you know, or don't want to be educated. You know, it's so sad when you think about the fact that you're feeling like this in a workplace where odds are there's a bunch of other people just like you in that workplace who are also feeling silenced and not taken seriously.
Yeah. You
know, it's a bummer.
But that's why we're doing the campaign, because it's about celebrating. Yes, it's about raising awareness, but it's actually for any social workers that are out there that are kind of like, do you know what, that's me, and actually this is a positive thing, and like I want to kind of embrace that, which is really good.
Yeah. So, Kevin, just on sort of what you were just saying before, right, now that I do a lot of work in the neurodiversity space, right, I meet so many people where I might be open about something and say, hey, look, you know, I struggle with that. And then I meet those other people on the other side of the things who, you know, would say that they're not, you know, neurodivergent or all of that. And, you know, they're sort of against me type of thing. And I think to myself in my head, I'm like, yeah, man, you're actually neurodivergent, but you don't know it. It's true. I can see it so often. Yeah, I see it so often now. I'm like, the way that you're acting, the way that you do stuff, the way that you're handling certain situations, I'm like, you're so neurodivergent, man, that, like, you know what I mean? And they're oblivious to it, you know what I mean? And it's sort of not funny to watch, but it's sort of like, if you only knew, my man, if you only knew. So interesting stuff. And I'm sure people come along across a lot of people like that. But also, too, so we are getting close to the end here. What are some positives in your industry around neurodiversity? And can I just say one thing that I thought was really cool, what you mentioned prior? You said that once you got diagnosed, you were able to actually, it seemed like you changed a lot of the things that you did, because you were now like, oh, my God, I'm going to change this because in my situation, I feel like this and I understand that. Right, which I thought was really cool. And maybe prior to that, you've probably felt that you had to conform to some type of, you know, process type of thing. But what have been some positives in your industry around neurodiversity support?
I think when I wanted to do something, I reached out to our association, so the Social Work Association, and I think I've only ever had positive responses. I've had a lot of people kind of going, yeah, wow, I didn't know that was a thing, but I'm listening. And I think that's the biggest thing. You know, being able to set up this group, I've had so much support just being able to set that up, doing the campaign, which is through the union, again, so much support straight away. The people that are, I suppose, influencing the profession are, there's a lot to do, of course. But I've never had a negative response. I've never had anybody kind of say, yeah, that we don't need to talk about that. It's always been taken on and always been so open to have discussions. And I think that's so positive, because that's how we're going to change things.
And you know what? Yeah. And you know what I'm starting to get a lot of? I'm starting to get a lot of neurotypical people reaching out, wanting to learn about it, wanting to maybe help develop some programs because they want to get a part of it. And some of the things that I've seen in the past, because I've been in the neurodiversity space for a lot, and I've actually seen, I've seen the good and bad sides of things. I've had people reach out. I still get people reaching out, like trying to put me down or certain things like that. Or what was it I was, what else was there? But I've completely forgotten my ADHD. What was I talking about?
The people, you know, in the industry, like Deb. Can I just say?
Neurotypical people. Neurotypical people. But what I've really tried to, sorry, I cut you off there, Kev. I just want to say before I forget. You know, the biggest thing is those people are reaching out, and it's like, yes, when we can have not just us trying to lead the way, but other people who maybe don't have anything, who don't, you know, identify that, that's the key to moving forward as well, you know, and that's the beauty of these people. And a lot of the time when they reach out to me, I will welcome them in with open arms and say, thank you so much. I love you. I want you. Whatever I can do to help you.
And I get so many, like, so many universities and things like that now reaching out to me saying, do you know what, we have loads of students that are neurodivergent. Can you come and talk? Can you come and, you know, support? So there's a real want to act. There's still some discrimination that goes on. Of course there is. And there's a lot of stuff to do. But I think people are so open to just learning, which is, that's how you're going to change it.
That's the thing, and that's what we're doing with Neurodiversity Academy, is trying to make this information more accessible and maybe more cost-effective, because I can tell you right now, and it sort of sucks that it's like this, but if I was to go to, say, a company and say, hey, you need neurodiversity training or whatever like that, they're always going to say, well, what's in it for us? Do you know what I mean? And, look, I could tell them what's in it for them, but they just don't see it that way. So, you know, we're trying to look at a lot of different ways that we can get universities involved and all other places at a reasonable price, or in a way that it's going to benefit them better for the future. And that's probably something I'll share a little bit in the next couple of probably months or something like that. But, Kev, did you have something else you want to share there, my man?
I was going to say, I mean, you know, Will, I'm always sort of, you know, because we talk a lot on this podcast about the challenges that people face and what needs to change and stuff. And I'm always wanting to talk about, okay, but what are the positives? And I think it always ends up being we are, you know, like Deb, you are the positive in your industry. You know, it's got to be led by us in conjunction with allies, but I think primarily by us, because we're the only people who understands what's going on. But I do think you know, there's obvious benefits to working with everyone.
So I think the best way to explain that is no one. So for example, no one, unless you're ADHD, would 100% know exactly what it's like to be ADHD, unless you're ADHD yourself. Do you know what I mean? But I think we can share information to help people understand not what it's like, but some of maybe the things that happen to people like us, or what we're going through, or why we might do certain things, or why we might get frustrated easy, or so something like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I know that I am a better social worker because I'm neurodivergent. I know that the skills that I have lend themselves to what I'm doing, and I can see that now. I know that I am better for it. Despite the challenges, I'm a better social worker because I'm neurodivergent.
Yeah, totally. And you know what? Yeah, you go, Kev.
Oh, and I think it's a case in a lot of industries too. I think that's the positive that a lot of employers don't understand is that when you bring in someone who thinks outside the box, you get new ideas. Often that's good because you're breaking out of this rigid bureaucracy of any workplace.
Yeah, and if you think most of my job is crisis management and trying to find solutions and stuff, and I'm normally the one that goes, yeah, but what about this? Why don't we do this? Well, and everyone's like, oh, good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they're sort of like, what are you talking about? Why would we do that?
That's
what I come across a lot of the time. But do you know what, right? In saying that, especially with, say, a lot of psychologists and stuff like that, and I've got a lot of friends who are psychologists who are neurodivergent, right? And a lot of the time they're like, oh man, I'm afraid to open up about being neurodivergent because there's a high risk that I could lose, like, I don't know, your license or whatever. And it's like, man, if anyone was going to be the best person to be a psychologist for ADHD or autism or whatever that is someone who is that themselves. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And look, in saying that, I think there is some really great doctors out there who have some really, you know, Tony Atwood, he's got an autistic son. I don't believe he's autistic, not from my knowledge, but, you know, he's leading the field. He's got some really great research behind him and everything. So stuff like that, you know, so there are good people out there doing some great work. Yeah. But like I said, at the end of the day, unless you're ADHD or autistic or dyslexic yourself, you will never truly 100% know what that's like to be like that person. Yeah.
And you see that in that outright dismissal in workplaces because it's just not even occurring to them that this might be a problem for you. In the same way that I think which is why, you know, I think misconceptions can be dangerous. We don't want to misconceive that person doesn't care necessarily. They might just be uneducated. There are cases where people are just assholes, but I think it's a similar way where we're missing that the other way around. You know, we might behave in certain ways that if you calculate why you would display that behavior in that situation, the way that you would get there would be, I'm an asshole. You know what I mean? Or I'm a bit rude or, you know, I'm not trying to paint us that way. It can be a lot of just confusing signals that we can give off to neurotypical people sometimes. You know, you got to remove those assumptions to make the conversation work.
And also too, right, like one thing that I've sort of come across as well is that I've sometimes had to go into situations when people have wanted me to fix the problem. Mm. Like, hey, we want to hire you so you can fix Kev up so he can start working better. And it's like, well, Kev's not the problem at all. It's this manager here is a taskmaster. The way that they're coming across to Kev is not the way that he's able to work correctly. He's feeling under pressure. And I've gone into situations like that. And I've even gone into and I've said that. I've said, look, he needs to change. He needs someone who's going to support him, blah, blah, blah. And I've been working with one person lately and he's got a new manager and all this type of stuff. And it's been amazing to see the change in the person. Because that manager has had a bit of a better understanding of how to better approach things with this person to bring the best out of that person.
Whereas in the beginning, they were kind of saying, hey, can you come in and help us make this person work like a neurotypical person?
Yeah. Well, yeah, totally. And so, he's never going to be like that, you know? Yeah. But in saying that as well, there's been times where even in like education and stuff like that, I've come across some people who, you know, they'll come and say, hey, look, I'm dyslexic or whatever like that. It's like, okay, well, here's everything you need. I'm dyslexic as well, so I know exactly what you need. But they've sort of used that as an excuse to potentially get out of things and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, man, that's not how it works, brother. You know what I mean?
You know, our friends and family have a responsibility to try attempt to understand and support us, but we have a responsibility to manage ourselves as best we can.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a two-way street. Yeah. You know, we can't just put the dyslexia or the whatever flag up and say, hey, look, now that's because of this. Mm. You know, if you put lay out everything for the person, there shouldn't be any necessary need to do that. So it's a two-way street. But, Kev, can you think of anything else you wanted to talk about before we shoot off?
Deb, really admire what you're doing. Are you aware of anything similar happening in Australia at all? Have you connected with anyone?
Well, no, I went to a conference recently, which is the International Federation of Social Workers Conference, and there was a lady from Australia who kind of said, well, we don't do anything like that in social work. We don't think about that. We don't have any groups like that. We don't have any support like that. I mean, she was only one person, obviously, but I'm finding, so we've got a Facebook group and we've got so many people that are joining from all over the world that it feels like there isn't like a specific group for neurodivergent social workers anywhere. It just feels like our industry is very interested in learning, but there's still so much fear around, say, putting your hand up and saying, hey.
So that was a really good way to end it here. So where can people find out more about what you do and connect? I'm assuming probably your Facebook group would be one of them, right?
Yeah. So we've got the Facebook group, which is just Neurodivergent Social Workers Group. Nice and simple. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter, which is,
you're on X now.
I'm on X. Yeah, we're on X.
And when you say I'm on X, that sort of sounds like wrong. Right? That sounds like you're on drugs or something.
I'm sorry,
right?
I'm on X.
Yeah. I'm on X, man. You know what I mean? Leave me alone.
Yeah. I mean, cool. We're on X, which I can't remember. I think it's ND_SW group. So we're on there. And then so I think that's probably the best way to find us.
You on Instagram?
Shall I put that in the chat?
If I don't know if like our listeners through the podcast platforms will pick that up, but yeah, if they just check that out, probably the best way to connect with you on LinkedIn as well, and you can send people stuff. So Deb Solomon, but I pronounced that correctly, cool. Awesome. Well, Deb, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for coming here early. You probably need to get to work now, so there'll be no going back to bed and catching up on the sleep that you've missed.
So
I apologize for that. But look, it's been actually really good to sit down with you and hear about all the great stuff you're doing. So thank you so much for coming on. Photon John, did you have anything else you wanted to say, my man?
I think that wraps it up nicely.
Thank you for having me. I think that's missing is that space, isn't it, to just talk about it.
Totally. When we can speak about stuff and be open about stuff, it's just amazing how many people start to come out of their shell. And you sort of feel a part of something, I think, regardless of how, you know, ridiculous that might sound in your head. You know, because I think some people are sometimes afraid to share certain things about themselves or their life or whatever. But when you can meet other people who do live that, some really great things can happen. So, Deb, thank you so much for coming on today.
No, thank you.
Not a problem. So for anyone else listening, if you haven't already done so, please subscribe, like, and follow to all of our social media platforms. Please subscribe to our website at openheartedsociety.com. My name's Will Wheeler with my co-host Photon John, and this is the Open Hearted Podcast. Until next time.